From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the April 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Focus on Josh Cooper. Thriving in the world of wartime codebreaking took more than just smarts and skill. Tact, diplomacy, and organisational talent were needed to achieve results and navigate the fractious politics of the intelligence community. In these circumstances, even the most shining of lights could be overshadowed by events. The achievements of outstanding talent could be almost lost to history, as the subject of this month's podcast proves. In this episode, the second in our Focus On series about remarkable figures in wartime codebreaking, we're joined by Research Officer Dr. Thomas Cheetham. He brings a personal insight into the career of Josh Cooper, the head of Bletchley Park's Air Section. Cooper was an intelligence pioneer, the legacy of whose tireless wartime work has been eclipsed by his eccentric personality. Our thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our historical documents. For our second episode in this sub-series, Focus On, Tom has picked a subject that you have a special fondness for, I think would be a good way of saying it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say I'm not going to approach this one in an entirely impartial manner, because we're talking about a man who I have a great deal of admiration for and I think deserves to be a lot more prominent than he is.
We've mentioned him countless times over the years, but only in passing, really, haven't we?
Yeah, if you read about Bletchley Park, he's somebody who will come up in passing, as you say, but very rarely do we get the whole story. Very rarely do we hear, ironically, about his work as opposed to his personality and some of his eccentricities as well. And we'll get onto that. And I think that's a shame, because Josh Cooper is certainly, as far as I can see, one of Bletchley Park's most talented codebreakers and organisers, and makes a huge contribution.
What's the headline here about Josh? How long is he here? What does he do?
Joshua Edward Synge Cooper. He joins GCNCS in 1925 as a pretty young man. He's in the profession of codebreaking and signals intelligence right through to when he retires, pretty much his lifelong work. So he's one of these, John Tiltman is an example people have probably heard of these long-term professional codebreakers, in contrast to people like Alan Turing, who just do it as a wartime job and return to their pre-war lives.
Pretty much like Emily Anderson that we did the previous.
And a lot like Emily Anderson,
yeah,
as well, yeah.
A lifetime codebreaker, really.
And similar again to her in that he's working in areas which don't receive as much attention as they might.
No.
But if we look at the detail, if we look at the impact of what they're doing, turn out to have been really important.
Let's go right back to the start. Give us some background on Josh.
He's from an Anglo-Irish family. He's born in 1901. His birthday's on the 3rd of April, so we're not too far off. And he gets a pretty typical upper class education. He goes to Shrewsbury School. He actually encounters, we think, Ronnie Knox, who is the Catholic priest who is the brother of codebreaker Dilly Knox, who's the classics tutor at Shrewsbury at that time during World War One. Then he goes off to read classics at Brasenose, Oxford, and ends up also doing a degree in Russian and Serbian at King's College London. So he's a linguist, and he's many times multilingual. He speaks all of the standard languages, French, German, Latin, Spanish, whatever. Also Russian, Serbian, also Arabic he has in his roster. You can see why he's good at this work.
Yeah.
He follows that classic model of a codebreaker, definitely.
He ticks every box, really, doesn't he?
As far as a pre-war kind of non-mathematical codebreaker goes, absolutely.
Now, after Josh has finished his education, does he go into the world of work?
Yeah, he actually ends up teaching at a prep school in Margate, which is not what he'd quite aspired to. So he stuck there for a few years. And then this opportunity crosses his path because he's tipped off about a job at GCNCS. It's pretty typical. It's through these personal connections. So his father is friends with the novelist Charles Morgan. And Morgan's sister knows somebody who works at GCNCS and happens to know that they need Russian linguists. And she says, oh, Josh, you should go down there and inquire. He obviously picks up on it this way. And then his name is put forward in one of these recruitment drives that GCNCS does from time to time to take on a few new hands to replace retirees. So he's in the same round as Hugh Foss, actually, when Hugh Foss comes in 1925. and takes this entrance exam. Cooper gives us, in sort of post-war account, a description of this. He says it had been devised by Oliver Strachey, included a number of puzzles such as filling in missing words in a mutilated newspaper article and simple mathematical problems calling for nothing more than arithmetic and a little ingenuity. I wasted a lot of time on these, thinking there must be some catch, and rechecking my work, and so did not finish the paper. Nevertheless, I got top marks, as I was told years later by W.F. Friedman, William Friedman, the American cryptanalyst, who'd seen the results published by the Civil Service Commission. And I've checked the results because they're in the archives.
All right.
And you can see some of the papers, and it's just as he describes. You have these, for a state-educated oik like me, terrifyingly complex.
Really?
Mathematical and linguistic reasoning tests, but for Cooper, you can imagine he would take it fairly in his stride. It's like a public school exam. Pretty typical of what, you know, the Civil Service Commission was testing people on at that point in time.
The actual questionnaire is in the archive.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the results page, which shows that Cooper did come top of his group.
Oh, brilliant.
Amongst 11 other candidates, so they took the top three or four.
Is Hugh Foss on the same list?
He is.
Oh, so he was higher than Hugh Foss?
He was higher than Hugh Foss.
What year is this?
This is 1925.
So he's only 24. He's very young, isn't he?
Yeah. This is when you need people. Yeah. This is when people are at the top of their game. It's just like in academic maths, you know. People get into their 30s and 40s, they start to lose their edge.
And to be told later by William Friedman that that's where he came in his test, that must have been weird.
It must have been satisfying, wasn't it? Yeah.
He's top of the class. What do they put him to work to do?
Well, he naturally goes to work on Soviet diplomatic as a Russian expert. The main expert at this point is a codebreaker called Ernst Fetterlein, who had been the chief cryptographer of Tsar Nicholas II and fled after the revolution, ended up in Britain. He's one of the people who basically teaches Josh how to break codes. Some of the material they're working on is what gets read out in Parliament after the Arcos raid. It's quite a pivotal moment in British-Soviet relations when they raid the All-Russian Cooperative Society headquarters in London, because it's revealed that they knew they'd been involved in subversive activities because of code breaking. The Russians go over to one time pad and they never read another Russian diplomatic message
until the 40s. Yeah.
He also goes over to Russian naval material after a bit, and this sees him posted to Palestine, to the Army Y station at Sarafand. And he's there for 15 months, I think, in 1929 to 1930. He spends a long time out there. And then back in Britain after that, he goes over to work on Italian with Emily Anderson, who we talked about
2 months
in the episode
ago.
Before last.
Yeah.
And by the way, he's just about the only person not to denigrate Emily Anderson as being a difficult old spinster. He seems to have just had great respect for her expertise and knowledge. So I think that reflects very well on him. I've also seen mentioned, it's hard to verify, but he might have been involved with a Spanish Civil War enigma as well before Diddy Knox took it over, which he breaks in April 36 in the end. So it's quite early on.
What to do in an air raid? Here are a few important rules to remember. Get under cover at once. Don't stand staring at the sky. Take cover at once. But don't rush. Take cover quietly, then others will do the same. If you're in the open with no cover, lie down. If your home is within 5 minutes, go there and take shelter. And keep away from windows. Admit passers-by, they need shelter too. Motorists, get off the main road, park close to the curb. Switch off headlamps, leave only side and rear lamps. Always carry your gas mask. See that your blackout is complete. Above all, don't stand staring at the sky. Take cover.
It seems from that his first, I'm guessing, 10 years of his career at GCNCS, he's kind of all over the place, isn't he? But he settles down finally, doesn't he, for what he's famous for, really?
Yeah, so that's how the organisation was. It was very flexible. People moved around from thing to thing because they're just breaking codes rather than doing intelligence. It's possible to reskill, shift into another language. They're all quite capable of doing that. So I think this is pretty typical. But from 1936, Cooper does specialise because he's put in charge of the new air section, which had just been set up. And this is really a reaction to the German Luftwaffe appearing for the first time. The Germans had had an air force, kind of in a clandestine way. But when the Nazis come in, they, within a couple of years, stop trying to pretend that they don't have an air force.
Yeah.
And then they are able to come onto the airwaves and start transmitting. And as soon as that happens, the RAF are monitoring that traffic and trying to analyse it. And not long afterwards, you have the Spanish Civil War and you have the Italian Air Force as well. A lot of activity from them, which the RAF, again, is picking up on. So the cryptography of these sort of tactical Air Force ciphers is quite simple, but you still need specialists at GCNCS to deal with it, so they set up the air section. And the main task they're looking towards is air defence.
Of the UK.
Of the UK. The big RAF project as part of rearmament before the war is building up this air defence system, which we normally call the Dowding system, slightly anachronistically. But it's about radar, it's about the observer corps, and it's also about radio interception. It's about why. And tying those all together with these control systems and control rooms that filter the information down from fighter command to the lower levels. So you can have this responsive fighter defence. And obviously it pays off in a big way in the Battle of Britain. And this is what the RAFY service is preparing to do in a really big way. You have William Swanborough, another kind of hero of mine, doing interception at a Y station at Waddington in Lincolnshire, and then later at RAF Cheadle. And we've talked about this before in episodes about the Battle of Britain. And, you know, after him and the head of Y at the Air Ministry, Cooper's probably the most important expert in how to do this, how radio interception can be used in air defence. They think about what the most efficient way of breaking the codes is and where that has to happen. And there's a recognition that GCNCS isn't necessarily the best place. Because if you think about simple tactical codes, you can break them quite readily as they're intercepted. But the time of getting messages here and breaking them and then sending them back to the Y station or back to the Air Ministry to actually be acted on is normally too long to get the best tactical benefit. So they realised this from 1938 or thereabouts, that you need to break the messages at the Y station itself. And Cooper actually sends some staff to Waddington and they do this experiment with Italian traffic to see if they can decode it on the spot. And it all works pretty well and proves the concept. So this is going to be the idea that a GCNCS will train what they call signal computers to go to the RFY stations and break traffic there. And air section here will be kind of backroom research.
This is computer in the old term.
Yes, it's computer in the term of somebody doing calculations, a human being doing calculations. The funny thing is that when all this plays out, Cooper is taken to task by Denniston back at GCNCS for what he calls what seemed to be an attempt to disrupt the unity of GCNCS.
Oh.
So it doesn't go down very well with his immediate bosses, but it's absolutely vital to preparing for this air defence mission.
This pre-war period, the adage is from Stanley Baldwin, I believe, the bomber will always get through. There's this view that there's not a lot you're going to be able to do about air defence. What's Josh Cooper's view on it? Do you know?
Well, what's interesting is that he's actually quite pessimistic, yeah. And it's not because of some vague kind of principle like that. Mm. It's because he can see what the practicalities are, and he can see with the resources the RAFY service has, they can't actually do enough monitoring to really work out what the enemy are doing. And also, they've got a good picture of what the Luftwaffe looks like. They've got a good picture of how many planes they've got, where they are. But all the enemy has to do a surprise attack is carry out effective radio silence. What the RAF's worried about is a sudden kind of knockout blow. That's the big fear. It doesn't happen in the end, but that's what everybody's scared of. And there's these kind of repeated alarms in the late 30s where they think the Luftwaffe is about to carry out a massive air raid that will just knock Britain out as a belligerent.
Pre-war?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh. You know, they have the same attitude to air attack as we have to ICBMs. So Cooper's constantly being called into control rooms and asked to give his opinion on stuff, being pulled out of bed in the middle of the night and flown to different air bases. And he says there's an occasion where he didn't think he'd see his family again. But none of these alarms come to anything. What Cooper knows is that the enemy are quite capable of carrying out an attack without RAFY being able to give any indication at all. So we've got actually a document in Cooper's hand from January 1939 where he explains exactly what the problems are going to be with this system that they've put together.
23rd of January, 1939. There are three ways in which warning of approach of enemy aircraft might be obtained through WT interception. 1. By interception of an enemy operation order. It is possible that we might by this means obtain warning of a sudden Italian attack on a British possession. E.g., we know that on the 16th of March 1937, the Italian Air Ministry gave an order by wireless for the terror bombing of Barcelona a few hours before the raids began. There is, however, no hope of intercepting any such German operation orders, which would probably not be sent by wireless, nor of deciphering them when intercepted. 2. By interception of signals from aircraft in the air. If raiding aircraft were to start transmitting signals by wireless when on their way to a target, we could fix their position by use of directional wireless, even if we did not understand the signals they made. We cannot, however, assume that raiders would have anything to say between leaving their bases and arriving over the target, still less that they would be so foolish as to say it by wireless. 3. By general inference from wireless signals, not, necessarily, from enemy air force. This method might prove very profitable as the war went on, and we gained experience of enemy habits. It was exploited very successfully in the war of 1914-18. It is not likely to give warning of the first raid in a war. If the enemy, at a time of political tension, were to make some sudden change in his normal peacetime wireless habits, our wireless interception service would, rightly or wrongly, ascribe a sinister motive to the change, and give notice that they had reason to believe that an attack was impending. This is the utmost we can hope for. Signed, J.E.S. Cooper.
It seems quite pessimistic, that document. Well, as you
said. Well, realistic.
Well, yeah, I suppose so, yeah. What's the RAF's view?
They humour him. But no, I think that's interesting in itself. The RAF, they don't react, by which I mean William Swanborough at the Y station and the Air Ministry. They don't say, who are you? Why are you butting in on business that isn't yours? So what's interesting is even though they're saying, don't worry about it, we've got it under control, we think it'll be all right on the night and we're going to carry on, which they're probably right to do to an extent. They recognise Cooper as an expert whose opinion is valid.
They do this with a lot of people, don't they? Yeah.
And this is really interesting because it suggests that Cooper fits into this model of the RAF using civilian expertise, which we see a couple of examples of Robert Watson Watt working on radar and also Barnes Wallace, people like that. The RAF have a lot of civilian scientific experts and they respect them and they try and make the best use of them. They don't have this hidebound attitude that we normally associate with the relationship between Bletchley Park and the outside world. So I think he is recognised as an expert. A really good example of that, he's the first member of GCNCS to know what radar is, or as they know it at the time, RDF, radio direction finding. He's taken to Bordsey in Suffolk, where they're testing this, and shown how it works. And when he goes back to GCNCS, he learns that Denniston and Edward Travis as well, they've never heard of it. They've got no idea what it is.
Oh.
He's the only person to know about the secret weapon.
So he's definitely trusted then, isn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He also takes part in the interrogation of the very first interrogation of a Luftwaffe pilot shot down over Britain in October 1939.
What, they pull him in to do that?
They pull him in to do that. And we'll learn more about that later. But he's clearly not just a backroom technical boffin. He's an authority on air intelligence. He's recognised in that way by the RAF.
He's been doing the job quite a while, really, before the war starts. So once the war starts, what state is the air section in?
Well, first off is that it's tiny. It's only 9 people. Pretty much the smallest team at GCNCS. But ironically, at the same time, they're all one of, if not the most successful. Because they're dealing with these quite simple tactical codes, they've broken all of them. They've broken all the German tactical codes. They've broken almost all the Italian ones. The Germans try and throw them off when war is declared and they change call signs and they change their fuselage numbers. And eventually they start swapping out old code books for new ones. But they keep on top of all that pretty effectively. So alongside those code breaking tasks, one of Cooper's first jobs is to bring in candidates to be those computers that they need at the Y station. They don't have staff on hand to send off straight away. Luckily, the Germans give us this day of execution at the start of the war, the phony war, of course.
Yeah.
So he has a chance to find the Cambridge undergraduates, train them in code breaking, and they're working at Cheadle from April 1940, in time for the Battle of Britain and the Battle of France as well.
6 years of hard training and actual battle experience in Spain and Poland have made the German army look invincible. But what about the British and French? First, let's take up the British. They started from scratch, but both at home and abroad, an army was growing. For not only Britain had declared war, the whole British Commonwealth of Nations was also determined on victory over Hitlerism and all it stands for. Between Britain and Germany stood not only France, but the little countries of Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. The people of these small neutral countries were peaceful, hardworking, and free. They knew they were in the middle and feared violation of their neutrality. Hitler knew this. He also knew that if they united with the Allies, they would form a solid democratic wall against Nazi aggression, and their conquest would be far more difficult. So before striking with his armies, he used another weapon, the propaganda barrage, to confuse, to make them lose faith, to divide and conquer. To lull the fears of the little neutrals, propaganda minister Goebbels told them Germany didn't want a war at all. It was Britain and France that caused all the trouble.
Now, I think I'm right in saying that one of the first Enigma keys that gets broken here is an Air Force key.
Yeah, and Air Force keys are the mainstay of the Enigma that they're breaking right through the war.
So how does Josh Cooper get involved with that?
Now, obviously, GCNCS goes into the war with this neat Army, Air Force, Navy setup, and each section breaks Army, Air Force, and Naval codes. So it makes a lot of sense. Following this system, Air Section should have got Air Force Enigma to work on. And at least you'd afford it should have, if not breaking the ciphers, receiving the messages, translating them, reporting them to the Air Ministry, because they are part of the Air Ministry.
Yeah.
And they're the correct channel. But what actually happens when Enigma starts being broken in early 1940, none of it's handled by Air Section. Because this is a new machine cipher and very different, and you need these mathematicians to break it, there are very valid reasons for saying we need a new team to break Enigma, separated out from the old code-breaking sections. So that's Hut 6. And they decide to set up Hut 6 in about November 1939. That's all been decided. Nobody's decided what to do with the messages, though. When the first Enigma messages start to appear, the first decodes, in January 1940, this is when Frederick Winterbottom, our old friend, the author of The Ultra Secret, who blows the lid on Bletchley Park in the 70s, but is, during the war, the head of the Air Section at MI6, and thus kind of first in line to look at these decodes.
His liaison.
Yeah, that's kind of what his role turns into. And what he does is he goes to Stuart Mingus, who's just taken over as head of SIS, and says, what if I get an agreement with the Air Ministry that we just handle this for them? So he goes to the head of Air Intelligence and Air Commodore Buss, and he reaches an agreement that the SIS will handle the breaking and the translation of all the Enigma material, and they'll just hand Air Ministry the results.
So this is SIS itself, not GCNCS, which comes under SIS.
Yeah, that's right. You can see the political advantages for SIS is that they get to control this source. They get absolute control over this new source of intelligence. And if it turns out to be of huge value, then they're going to benefit from it. And also there's a security argument as well, which is kind of a better justification.
So instead of two stages, you'd have one stage. I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that the problem Air Section has is that it's technically an offshoot of the Air Ministry. It's AI-1E of Air Intelligence. Now, the fact that the Air Force is doing tactical interception isn't really a secret, because everybody does this. The Germans are doing this. Every other country is doing this. The Germans know that the RAF does this. And lots of other people in the government and in the intelligence world in Britain know the RAF does this. So if a decode ever gets back to the Germans and it's associated with AI-1E, there is a fair chance that they'll be able to work out that it has something to do with radio interception, and they'll be able to connect it to Enigma. And then the whole game will be up. There's a very valid security argument that you have to segregate Enigma from what Air Section is doing. But it comes at an organisational cost, and the cost is your own Air Section and actually the signals intelligence specialists at the Air Ministry as well. They're all bypassed in this system because the decrypts go straight from Bletchley Park to the German intelligence section at the Air Ministry, not to their own radio people. So you have one channel for Enigma, one channel for tactical code breaking, and the two initially don't meet. And that causes all sorts of trouble.
I'm going to say that doesn't seem like that's going to help matters at all.
Obviously, two lines of traffic, both come from the German Air Force, that often being sent from the same radio stations, being dealt with by completely different people in Britain in the code breaking and the interpretation.
Like I said, that really doesn't seem like a great idea. How did Cooper react to this?
He seems to have dealt with it with good grace, but we don't actually have a statement from him as to his role in this.
Yeah.
Arthur Bonsall, who is one of those undergraduates who Cooper brings in early in the war, later director of GCHQ, he does tell us that Cooper was pretty unhappy with being left out of Enigma. And the irony is, as soon as Hut 3 gets off the ground to do the translation, Nigel de Grey, who we've heard about before, he's kind of Grey eminence, who has his fingers in all the pies at GCNCS, he has to do a lot of work setting up links with the Air Ministry and making sure that Huttfree have the background about what we know of the German Air Force to let them do their translations. And in another building at GCNCS, you've got the air section. You know all about this stuff already. So almost as soon as you segregate these two lines of work, those barriers start breaking down. And the story of air intelligence that's actually part for the rest of the war is really about breaking down those barriers. But it takes a long time to get there.
And it's at the point in time where air intelligence is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not. So none of this is solved, really, not in a major way, until after the Battle of Britain and after the Blitz. It really does hinder things.
So if Cooper is basically told he's not going to work on it, is that the last he works on Enigma then? Or it can't be, obviously.
Well, it isn't, because basically he's indoctrinated. He knows they're breaking Enigma. He is at that level where he's got basically full knowledge of this, and he's able to keep on top of it. So he's pretty heavily involved from outside Hut 3 and Hut 6 on what's going on, especially in doing a lot of the liaison. He's quite similar to John Tiltman in this sense, because we often talk about how John Tiltman is a fantastic professional codebreaker, but also a really astute diplomat.
Yeah.
And Cooper has his diplomatic moments as well. So he's involved with talking to Gustave Bertrand of the Deuxième Bureau during the Battle of France. And when Bertrand has his codebreaking organization on the road in central France, fleeing from the Germans, and he's sending the last few messages to GCNCS saying, don't worry, your secret's safe with me. I'm not going to tell the Germans about Enigma. All those letters are actually going to Josh Cooper. He's the one who Bertrand is talking to.
Because you would have expected it to be Turing, because Turing had been going to France.
Turing can't have those conversations. It's just not his forte. He goes over there does a bit of liaison work with the codebreakers themselves. But, you know, the policy stuff is at a much higher level. That's where Cooper's working. So he does that. And a bit later on, there's a similar role Cooper takes up when you have Combined Bureau Middle East, CBME, working out in Egypt during, 1941, 1942, when that's the front line of the war. And Cooper is put in charge of liaison with CBME. So when they start decoding Enigma messages in the field using the keys provided by Hut 6, when they break the keys, they send them to Cooper and he passes them on to CBME. So he's got a quite pivotal role in parts of the Enigma story and just having conversations and facilitating communication with the different parties. Besides the fact that a lot of Air Section's day-to-day work is informed by Enigma. They're using its background intelligence. They're trying to tie up Enigma with the low-grade traffic. Most members of Air Section aren't indoctrinated, so Cooper is having to manage that and work out who has to be indoctrinated and who doesn't, and ensure the security is maintained. You know, that selectivity is in place until September 1943. So Cooper's responsible for working out who has to be in the picture and who doesn't. So as a slightly tangential figure in the Enigma story, he's quite important.
Another service maintaining close cooperation with the 8th Army is the South African Air Force. Here, some of the boys are being briefed during one of those sandstorms which are unfortunately laid on in these parts. These pictures were taken at the beginning of Rommel's push. The South Africans were taking off in their Bustons for raid after raid against the Afrika Korps. Our newsreel cameraman on the spot flew with them on at least one of the attacks. He obtained a really good impression of what it's like to do a spot of daylight bombing over the Libyan desert at about 6,000 feet. Over the target, away go the bombs, accurately aimed at what appear to be mere specks in the desert. This was an operation carried out against the enemy early in the Libyan battle. Since then, our bombers have been hitting back continuously at the enemy's advancing column, hitting hard at his airfields and supply lines. Like our submarines, doing everything in their power to help the land forces fighting the Battle of Egypt.
To put all of the politics and security to one side, I mean, Air Section is still working. What does their work look like in general, day to day?
So they're still keeping on top of all those low-grade codes. What they realise is they've basically got a traffic analysis problem rather than a code-breaking problem at this point, because if you read a message saying, I've just dropped a bomb, or my position is XYZ, unless you understand who's sending that message, what they're flying, what map grid they're using, and all of that contextual information, there's no use for that tactical message. It's worthless. And they're dealing with thousands of these. So you need that structure to put them in. And that requires a lot of work in the first couple of years to contextualise the tactical traffic. And the other problem is getting that information to the right people. We've talked about this in the episode on Battle of Britain. Cooper's heavily involved in kind of solving those issues. So the tactical traffic goes from being, you know, interesting tidbits that you're reading to actual actionable intelligence.
Because I guess they've had to build up a picture of when they're sending these messages, what they have to do with an operation or what they have to do with an actual sortie. They've got to learn all that before they can work out what's going to be useful, haven't they?
Yeah, and you can only learn that during the war by experience of the operations the Germans are actually carrying out. So it takes time. But Cooper's big concern is fighting for the right of his section to do intelligence. And it's quite familiar to the experience that people will have read about with Hut 3, in some ways, at least superficially speaking. Air section is meant to break codes. They get to the point where they know this material better than anyone else. They can interpret it better than anyone else. And therefore, it makes sense for them to be doing that, not experts that want to remove in the air ministry. But the problem air section has is that the RAF knows how it wants to do signals intelligence. It's got a whole system it set up before the war to do signals intelligence. Yep. And by producing their own reports and trying to disseminate them, air section is exceeding its remit because it's just meant to break codes. And that's quite different from the experience of Hut 3 or also the naval section at GCNCS.
Why is that? Because we hear Hinsley say at the start of the war, oh, they didn't want to listen to me, but then there's the whole story of HMS Glorious being sunk, and that supposedly convinces them all. What's the difference there?
Hinsley's problem is at that point in the war, the Admiralty doesn't know what SIGINT is.
Oh, the Air Ministry have their own sections.
Right, yeah. So when Hinsley rings up the Admiralty and says, I've got this SIGINT, you should listen to me, they go, what SIGINT, who are you?
Right, okay.
If Cooper was to do the same with the Air Ministry, they wouldn't say, what SIGINT? They would say, why are you doing this and not our SIGINT expert?
Right, that makes sense now.
So you have a very similar outcome, but the reason for it is exactly the opposite. It's not because this kind of intelligence is brand new and nobody knows what they're doing with it. RAF SIGINT suffers because they have too good an idea about what they want to do.
Right, okay.
And they don't have the flexibility to say, oh, actually, Air Section are best placed to be the ones interpreting this stuff.
So they're should let them get poaching on their job, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Press home your attack. If you individually succeed, you will have delivered the most devastating blow against the very vitals of the enemy. Let him have it right on the chin. Send that message to all groups and stations.
That was how Air Marshal Harris, Commander-in-Chief Bomber Command, gave his instructions for the largest air raid the world has ever known. At aerodromes up and down the country, well over 1,000 British-built bombers were being prepared for their journey over the heart of Germany's biggest industrial center, the Ruhr. While armorers and fitters were at work on the machines, the air crews were receiving final instructions from station commanders.
In the opinion of the weather prophets, this is the night, and the plan is on. Now, the target is an old friend to many of you. It's the city of Cologne. The route is almost direct. I'll show it to you. Base, Uchtdorf, direct to Cologne. On your target there, turn southwest, Euskirchen, and then direct to Nordland, and then direct to base. That's all. Good luck to you all.
Outside, the huge bombers were being loaded with the largest cargo of high explosive and incendiary bombs ever to be carried by one striking force to a single objective. As you can see, the WAF were directly concerned in this all-important job. At dusk, the colossal force set out. Heavy bombers of many types took off from aerodromes all over the country. Only perfect staff work could have achieved the devastating success of this raid. For something like an hour and a half, bombs were dropping at the rate of about 20 tons a minute. Just work that out.
Now, if the Air Ministry don't want the air section poaching their job, what else are air section doing? You know, they must be doing something to earn their keep.
Yeah, they do make progress and they do kind of expand into new lines of work. One job they take on is when you've got to the point where the security cordon around Hut 3 is a little bit weaker. And this only takes a few months, but they eventually start getting to the point where they can put people in Hut 3 to have that fusion of high grade and low grade code breaking. And from the end of 1940, you have a section called SALU. It's named after John Saltmarsh and Peter Gray Lucas. One of them is an Enigma expert, one of them is a low-grade expert. And they sit together in Hut 3 and they try and tie the low-grade to the high-grade material, which has confused people no end because they seem to kind of belong to air section and Hut 3 at the same time. And that organisational distinction isn't very obvious. But what SALU becomes is the main authority on the German Air Force in the West and what the Germans are doing with their reconnaissance and their bombing operations. Because the Enigma tells you where they're based and what their orders are, and the low grade, you can see them actually carrying those orders out.
Yeah.
So you need both sides of the coin. That's really valuable. And later on, they have kind of smaller versions of SALU set up in North Africa, in Cairo, and after Operation Torch in Algiers, to do a very similar job. So that's brand new, and that's a niche that Air Section fills pretty effectively. And they are allowed to issue that intelligence in certain ways that the Air Ministry is happy with. It's useful. And the other thing that falls into their lap is voice traffic, radio telephony, or RT, especially of German night fighters. We've talked about this before in episodes 170 and 171, mm-hmm. about the work that Bletchley Park is doing to support Bomber Command. Because the RT's big value is understanding how German fighters work and night fighters and how the air defense system works over Germany. It's absolutely invaluable for Bomber Command.
Because even if it's, you know, it's not valuable on the night, it's valuable to study post-operation, isn't it?
Yeah. So you understand how the system works, how the tactics work. It's not a code-breaking problem because this is all in clear. This is unencrypted voice traffic. But because the German pilots are using a bunch of code words and following quite strict procedures to try and conceal what they're doing, it sort of is a code-breaking problem at the same time. Hinsley, later on, when he's writing the official history of British intelligence, he actually talks about how this is one of the most difficult intelligence problems of the whole war, working out how the German air defences work from this RT traffic. And it's a controversial one because Arthur Bonsall, later on in his life, is a very severe critic of the Air Ministry's reaction to this work. And there's still a controversy to this day, really, about whether the products of that analysis get to the right customers as promptly as they should, especially Bomber Command, and whether they were deprived of intelligence that would have saved lives of Allied aircrew. But I think, I mean, I've talked about this in previous episodes, I think they do get to a point where it's working pretty effectively. And they overcome that opposition from Air Ministry, and they manage to get to a point where they are making a big contribution.
You went into this in great detail in episodes that you mentioned earlier, 170 and 171, the BMP reports that they were issuing daily. You said earlier that Cooper was a great diplomat. What role is he playing in the middle of all of this? Because there's obviously arguments going on here, isn't there?
Absolutely. It does get quite fraught at times. And you see Cooper's name in all sorts of places in the files. He's absolutely a constant presence. And I think it's really telling that he never gets argumentative. He never criticizes. He's always cordial and constructive. Cooper obviously wants Air Section to make a name for itself, and he wants its intelligence to be spread far and wide. He understands that if they're going to do that, alienating the Air Ministry is not the way to get there. What's interesting is he has these kind of young terriers. He has these undergraduates who are more argumentative than he is, people like Arthur Bonsall and Peter Gray Lucas, who are full of new ideas, who like to write these memos, send them to all and sundry, and have the argument. And Cooper's role as somebody slightly older and slightly more responsible in his position is to rein them in, smooth over ruffled feathers, keep the whole show on the road, going in the right direction, and basically going when they need to go, maybe a little bit later than some would have liked. But reining in those young bloods is quite an important role, I feel like he must have played.
He must have been very good at it, because I recall so many oral history accounts when Josh Cooper's mentioned in a managerial role, there's nothing but praise mentioned about him. I think everyone says what a great boss he was. You don't get that with every section at all.
He's definitely not a difficult figure. People like him. Maybe not at first. I'll come on to that in a bit. But he's very well liked. I think you can definitely argue he's not the most efficient organiser. He organises in a loose way, in a more like that kind of traditional GCNCS way.
That's probably why he's thought of so highly by the staff.
Yeah, and he's not an onerous manager.
No.
And he would have been, let's be fair, pretty useless in charge of the bomb section or the tabulating section or somewhere you need to run it like a factory. But in charge of a code-breaking and intelligence section where things are a bit more freewheeling, he's pretty effective.
We said quite early on in this that at the start of the war, there were 9 people in the air section.
Yeah.
It grows, obviously. I mean, what does it grow to? It's one of the few sections that is breaking stuff all the way from the first day to the end of the war, isn't it?
Yeah, so eventually it grows up to about 300 staff. They're breaking German tactical codes. They're doing low-grade codes on ground networks as well, a bunch of different minor codes for all sorts of purposes. They're doing medium grade, which is double play fare used by the German Air Force, doing that Enigma tie-up work through the SALU section with HUT 3. Towards the end of the war, they actually start a watch in the air section that basically does what the watch in HUT 3 does. They translate and summarise decodes and send them on to commands. But it's not high-grade Enigma traffic, it's low-grade. But they're doing that. You have the BMP reports, which you mentioned. A huge area of work which Cooper's responsible for, which gets very little attention, is meteorological codebreaking, something we might have to raise in a future podcast.
I think we should, because we've mentioned the Met section quite a few times over the years. I mean, they had their own hut, but we don't really talk about them, do we?
They're a bit of a Cinderella. So they deserve more attention, and Cooper's in charge of that because the RAF controls the Met office, so Air Section gets Met codebreaking. And I haven't even talked about Italian, really, and Japanese codebreaking, because those are areas that Air Section expands into later in the war as well. So the range is huge. And the range of customers as well, the range of relations they have with the RFY service, with the Air Ministry, with the US Air Force when they come in, with places like CBME and the Far East Combined Bureau when they start working on Japanese. Cooper's handling all those outside relationships as well. Looking at Cooper's personal role, to add it to the list, he's John Tiltman's deputy in the research section, which is where all the work on the fish ciphers comes out of. So it's a remarkably long list of responsibilities. If you look at a well-regarded figure like Eric Jones, just has to deal with Army Air Force Enigma.
Yeah.
What Cooper's doing is much wider than that. It's more like what Edward Travis is having to do as head of GCNCS, or Nigel de Grey, who's got his fingers in all the pies, you know. He's more on that level, I think, if you look at the range of responsibilities that he's having to worry about. I think he gets recognised for that, and there's a really nice little quote from Edward Travis in his end-of-year report for 1942, where he says, everything Air Section was doing was handled with the clearness of foresight which has always characterised its head.
And 42 is the year he takes over, isn't he? So he's director at that point.
And he's very happy with what Air Section is achieving at that point in the war.
He should be, with the amount of jobs he's doing by the looks of it.
And this is why Cooper is so busy. I think this is something else that comes from. He's one of the hardest working people that you can imagine. He lives with his family just outside the BP gates in one of the houses that had been built by Captain Faulkner just before the war on the road running up to the main gate. But he's barely ever there. And we actually have a bit of a recording with his son, Michael Cooper, talking about those rare times that his dad was actually home during the war.
My name's Michael Cooper. My father was Jas Cooper, and he was in charge of the Air Section here at Bletchley. I think probably in 1942, but I can't be certain what year, because I was very small. I would have been four in 1942. We moved into the last house on Wilton Avenue before you get to the gates of Bletchley Park. And in fact, it was very nearly after you get to the gates of Bletchley Park, because we were going to be inside the security fence until my mother noticed what was going on and persuaded them to put us outside the security fence. Otherwise, we would have had to have shown passes every time we came in and out. Oh, what do I remember? Well, I'll tell you, I remember my father. The answer is not a hell of a lot, because he wasn't there very much. He worked all the time. We would see him for lunch on Sunday. He would sleep in on Sunday, and it was the only day he did sleep in. We would all have lunch. I'd probably bug him. Probably I did more for Hitler than I did for Churchill in the course of the war. I'm bugging the poor old guy, but we would listen to Itmar. We would listen to Tommy Handley until Tommy Handley died. We would listen to that show on the radio, and then off he would go to work on Sunday afternoon. He just spent most of his life here at Bletchley. And I think one of the reasons was that he was a very conscientious man, and he knew that all the time that there were people putting their life on the line, and he just did everything he could. He was a modest man after the war. All he'd say was that he believed that he'd saved some lives, and that was the thing that he was proud of having done.
So he works incredibly hard. He never stops working. And Gordon Welchman mentions in his book, you know, about the pressure Josh Cooper was under. He says, I remember being told by Josh Cooper that his work was an almost intolerable strain. Success so often depended on flashes of inspiration for which he would be searching day and night with the clock always running against him. Because, of course, at the middle of this, all this managerial work, he's still breaking codes. He's still doing all the cryptanalysis. That's what most of his brain is full of. And I think that preoccupation with the work, it helps to explain some aspects of his character and his behaviour as well.
I was going to say, does that lead us on to the myths and stories that have built up around
what
him?
What was he actually like?
Yeah.
I purposely didn't bring this up earlier because I wanted to lay out the record of his achievements before we actually talk about what Cooper was like to work with, or if you were to meet him.
I think that's one of the important factors in these Focus On episodes, because we're bringing these people that we may have only mentioned once or twice, or in Cooper's case, dozens of times, we've maybe focused on one single thing that they did during the war. But this gives us, you know, the whole view of that person. I think you've done that really well. But as you say, I think we've got to the point where we have to talk about the characteristics of the man.
Yeah, it's a problem in the way Bletchley Park has been written about that the eccentricities do often take centre stage.
They're a good hook to hang the story on.
Absolutely. Cooper is definitely one of the most stereotypical BP eccentrics you can imagine. So he's a tall man, he's a large man, he's described as sort of bear-like.
Right.
And he dominates the room and physically imposing. And for a lot of the young women who are working with him especially, he's quite frightening when they first meet him. Gwen Watkins, in her book about air section, she passes on some recollections of her friend David Vent, who joined air section a bit before she did. I don't know if you want to read this out, Mark, this section from her book about the day that David met Josh Cooper for the first time.
David was sent to a small wooden hut outside the gates. In it, he found a room empty of everything but the table and two chairs. Sitting in one of the chairs was an immense man like a grizzly bear. He gave no sign of seeing his visitor. His eyes, overhung by heavy dark eyebrows, stared blankly ahead. His face was a huge landscape of crags and fissures, but it was a landscape utterly devoid of humanity. No sign of welcome or recognition appeared as David nervously spoke his own name. But when he laid his letter on the table, a series of seismic waves and fissures broke across the face. It was like looking at a small earthquake. The great bulky figure leapt to its feet, knocking over the chair in the process, and seized David's hand in its huge paw. You kind of picture a codebreaker as being a small, tweedy person with glasses, and he's not that picture, is he, at all?
So, yeah, he's really imposing. He's got these kind of physical tics as well, which people pick up on. He's got a habit of scratching his left ear using his right hand, which hooks behind his head.
Yes, we've heard this before, haven't we? Yeah.
And it's described sometimes as picking apples from an invisible tree behind his head. And he tangles himself up like this. We've actually got a sketch in our collection showing him in this behaviour, so people tend to think that's a bit strange. And he dashes up and down the corridors with his huge bulk, kind of bowling people out of the way, because he's too busy thinking to actually pay attention to what's going on around him. We've got, you know, an explanation from Julia Lidecker, who worked in the air section, who says Cooper was apparently completely mad and frightened us all out of our wits. He was a big man with very black hair that fell all over his face, wore round black-rimmed spectacles, and had a habit of walking along deep in thought, clutching his right ear with his left hand. So that's the other way around on that occasion, but whichever hand it was. The corridor down the centre of Hut 10 was very narrow, and if from one end you saw Josh approaching, you scuttled into the nearest doorway, as he was so deep in thought he would not have seen anybody and would probably have knocked us flat. If walking outside, he was to be seen hopping on and off the curb by the side of the road. He accompanies this with these sorts of shouts and these sorts of shrieks that he makes when something exciting is happening, which also kind of terrifies people until they get to know him. But his kind of main characteristic maybe is that the main reason for his eccentricity is that he was deeply socially awkward. And his secretary, Anne Lavelle, tells us he'd get awfully embarrassed and worried when he felt he wasn't acting like an ordinary human being. And this leads to all sorts of strange occurrences. If you remember earlier in the episode, I mentioned the interrogation that Cooper was involved with.
Yes, the first German prisoner.
Yeah. Also in the room was R.V. Jones, the scientific intelligence expert from the Air Ministry.
A hero of both of ours.
Absolutely. And he writes about it in his book. And he says, you know, the interrogation team entered the room. And when they'd settled themselves down, the door was thrown open and the prisoner marched in. He was a typical product of Nazi success. His uniform was smart, his jackboots were gleaming, and his movements executed with German precision. As he came to the centre of the room, he was halted and turned to face the panel. No sooner had he executed his turn than he clicked his heels together and gave a very smart Nazi salute. For this, the panel were unprepared, and none more so than Josh, who stood up as smartly, gave the Nazi salute, and repeated the prisoner's Heil Hitler. Then, realising he'd done the wrong thing, he looked in embarrassment at his colleagues and sat down with such speed that he missed his chair and, to the prisoner's astonishment, disappeared completely under the table. So he's a man who really doesn't know how to act in public. It leads to the most enduring anecdote which we have about Josh Cooper is the coffee cup story, which is in every single book. And so many writers now love to speculate about how many cups there must be in the lake because the codebreakers were chucking their crockery in.
Yeah.
Right? This is a story that Cooper is drinking a cup of coffee by the lake and gets to the bottom of the cup and feels awkward about holding an empty cup, so he just chucks it in the water. This is obviously a story that went around air section during the war. You can just tell from the frequency of which it crops up that it's a wartime joke. And what those writers missed the point about is that it wasn't everyone doing this, it was just Josh Cooper because he was that weird. The point of the story is that even at BP, Cooper is especially eccentric.
Yes.
Even by Bletchley Park standards.
He might only have ever thrown one cup in the lake, but because he's done that, and because people know he's a bit weird, it just becomes folklore, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it takes on life of its own. Mm. And now, everyone knows about the cups, but nobody's heard of Josh Cooper, ironically enough. It's kind of sad.
It gets changed slightly that it becomes Turing who throws his cup in the lake. I've read that in some places.
Compared to Cooper, Turing was perfectly well put together.
Yeah.
The point is, these anecdotes are true, you know. He was odd. These anecdotes are told in good humour by people who knew and deeply respected Josh Cooper. And it's not on them, it's on modern-day writers, I think, that as a result, he's more often mentioned kind of as an object of curiosity than for what he achieved.
I think I can safely say that you've done Josh Cooper a great service in this episode, Tom. Hopefully it will lead people to wanting to learn more about him. Just finish the story off for us post-war. What happens to him?
Well, he stays on at GCHQ like many others do. We obviously don't know a great deal about his post-war work,
no.
But we know he stays in the profession. So we can speculate. I mean, just after VJ Day, he's appointed as head cryptanalyst in a new Latin section at the new GCHQ. So by Latin, they mean French, Portuguese, Spanish,
okay.
Those languages, you know, Latin American traffic.
Yes, not Latin language.
So it's possible that that's what he specialised in early in the Cold War. You know, he's a Russian expert. He publishes translations of Russian literature.
In his public life?
Absolutely, while he's working at GCHQ or just afterwards.
Okay.
So it doesn't take much guessing to imagine what he might have been up to during the Cold War. We know he was friends with John Tiltman and William Friedman, at least in the 60s, because they're photographed together. They're all good friends with each other. And he remains in GCHQ until 1961 and then dies in Great Missenden in 1981 at the age of 80.
So again, same as Emily Anderson, he spends his entire working career in codebreaking.
Absolutely. Again, if he'd been somebody with another string to his bow, if he'd gone and done something in the public sphere, we might know more about him. But as with so many of these long-term GCHQ employees, it tends to contribute to a certain amount of obscurity.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.